Okay, we're going to start here on the second line on Yud Ched Amud Aleph. Yesterday we left off with the machloka between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi with regards to how does cutting nails relate to cutting one's hair. Rabbi Yehuda thought there was a parallel between them, that wherever you cannot cut hair, you also cannot cut nails. Whereas Rabbi Yossi believed that even though you couldn't cut hair, you still could cut your nails. The Gemara concluded with Shmuel's statement, which is Alochat Kedivrei Mekel Be'avel. And everybody agreed by Chol HaMoed, there was no restriction against cutting one's nails. Shmuel comes along and says that Avilut is the same way because Alocha is like the one who is more lenient in Avel. The original thought being that Chol HaMoed doesn't need any strengthening because it's a Din D'Oraita, whereas Avilut, which is a Din D'Rabbanon, might need strengthening. So you would say that it's more Chamur by Avilut. Along comes Shmuel and says that we pass in the same way consistently with Rabbi Yossi across the board. Now we have a story. Pinchas Achua de Mar Shmuel. Pinchas, the brother of Shmuel, Itra Bemilto. Itra Bemilto in the Gemara means usually something bad happened to him. Usually means that somebody passed away and now he's in a veil. Obviously here it must be someone who was not a common individual or relative between them, whether they're only half brothers or they could be full brothers and you talk about a child of one of them or you talk about a wife. It's not clear here who the party that passed away was. But it's clear that only one of them is Ba'avelut, which is, in the first instance, Pinchas is Ba'avelut, and Al Shmuel de Mish'al, Taima Mineh. Shmuel comes to speak to him, to give him comfort, to be Menachem him. Chazino de Tofrei, Davin Efishan. He saw that his nails were very long. Amalei, Amailo Shakout Lahu. Why don't you cut your nails? They look terrible. Zamalei, Ibididi, Hava, Mimzal, Pekuli, Hai. If you were Ba'avelut, would have you been so mizalzel to cut your nails during Avelut? If you were in my position, you were in my predicament, you wouldn't have cut your nails. Have a shkigua shiotze mifli ha-shalit. It was as if like the word came out of the ruler. And once the ruler mumbles something, says something, it's going to come true because everybody listens to the ruler. So here it's as if he was koveya that this is going to happen. Ve'itre be'milta b'shmua. Sure enough, Shmuel became an avel because Pilcha said, if you were an avel, wouldn't you be so zalzel? Would you been so brash to cut your nails and to do this in the middle of your avelut? And so Shmuel then is captured by the fact that Pinchas said, if you were an avel, so now Shmuel is an avel. Al Pinchas achua the mishal tam aminei. Again, you have the same thing that Pinchas is not an avel and Shmuel is an avel. Pinchas comes now to comfort his brother Shmuel. Shaklinu le tofrei. Shmuel took his nails that he had cut off and chavtinu lape. Threw him or slammed him in his face. Amalei, leidlach brit krutal shvatayim. How come you didn't worry about the fact that there's a covenant with the lips, which is damar Rabbi Yochum inayin shebrit krutal shvatayim? How do we know that what you say has impact? Shinemar, vayomar Abraham el naraf. Abraham says to his lads, shrulachem poim achamor, vani vanar nelchad go. I and the young man will go there. Vinishtachave will bow down. Vinashuv aleichem. And we will return to you. Vistaya Milta. And sure enough, that's what happened. The Hadur Tarvayu, that they both came back. So even though Abraham had no way of knowing what was going to happen, but the fact that he said it in a manner which says, we will return, then it came true. In a sense that whatever he said did come true. So the problem that Shmuel had with what Pinchas did was that Pinchas then said, well, if you're an Ovel, sure enough, that's what's going to happen. He became an Ovel. Tosafot over here notes that he's not sure why Shmuel used this terminology and not another terminology that the Gemara uses, which is, the Gemara says, Lom aiftach adam piv the Satan. Christian shouldn't open up his mouth to the Satan, which is a similar concept. There they use the pasuk from the beginning of Yeshayahu, Shimu Dvar Hashem Ktzinei Sodom, that the way that Yeshayahu speaks about the people, then Hashem takes his lead and goes ahead and calls them by that, calls them by the Ktzinei Sodom. So there you see the fact that he opened his mouth to something bad, that sure enough, that's what happens. That's how it turns out to be. So he says that it's possible here that the example brought by the Gemara, Brit Krutal Shvatayim, is only by Midah Tova, by something good. Because by Abraham, it was for the good that he had said something and then it came true. For bad, you would more likely use the terminology, Al Yiftach Adam Piv LeSatan. The Maharsha distinguishes between them and says that Al Yiftach Peh LeSatan is when a person is speaking about themselves. And kishkigra yotze mipi ashalit or brit kutrales vatayim is when an individual is speaking about another person. So the differentiation of when they're used is one is used when it's self-referential versus one is used when it's talking about another party. And that's how he distinguishes between them and doesn't see them as the same problem. So Tosfot sees them being of the same ilk or the same concept, but maybe one referring to the good and one referring to the bad. You put them together and you have the concept, which is you have to be careful what you say. That many times people slip up and say something, or they direct it at somebody, that it comes true. That sometimes what you say has impact. Impact in the sense that what you say then becomes reality. And so we have to be very careful how we speak and how we conduct ourselves with others. And Shmuel was extremely upset at his brother Pinchas because he felt that the reason that the Avilut came upon him was because Pinchas had phrased his conversation with him in that manner, which is, well, if you were an Avil, you wouldn't have been Mezalzel like this. They basically decreed that Shmuel was going to be an Avil, and he was upset about that. But you're saying that the idea of it, maybe it's an Ayin Hara, or that doing certain things brings about the reality. Here, the Gemara is very focused on speech being the trigger over here. It's not simply that if you act a certain way, do a certain thing, but simply speaking, the power of speech is what's koveya. Now, that's interesting because we know that the uniqueness of a human being is speech. Because when in Bereshit it says that Hashem blows Nishmat Chaim into Adam, and then he was the Nefesh Chaya, he became a living being, the way that the Targum translates that is the Ruach Mimalala, is a speaking being. So that's the unique aspect of the human being is speech. And so speech is this trigger or this pivot that causes the problem, that speech has impact. And I think that's something that, especially today, where words are cheap, that people don't take as much care and are not as careful about how they speak and how they conduct themselves. And they just say whatever's on their mind, they say whatever. They don't consider the impact of what they're saying. They don't consider how much speech can impact. And I think here the Gemara is highlighting this idea that sometimes when you just throw things out there, it's not true. Speech has to be cared for. It has to be careful how we conduct ourselves and how we speak, because it does have impact. So now the Gemara jumps back to Shmuel's statement, which is, Sabra Minei. So they thought to explain the position of Shmuel, to modify or qualify that position of Shmuel, that Allah is Gedivrei HaMekil by Avel, that you cut your nails, that's only by your hand nails. In Deregel Lo, but your toenails, that is not true. Samarava Anan Bar Tachlifa, the Didim of Fashali Mine de Shmuel, I had Shmuel's statement explained to me, and there was no such qualification. Lo Shna Diyad, Velo Shna Deregel. Doesn't matter whether it's the hands or the feet. Both of them, you are allowed to cut the nails. There's no problem. So the Sabra Mina, the Hava Mina was that the fingernails were more ma'us than the toenails. Today, you would say because of exposure, that the fingernails are more exposed than your toenails. But in their day, they were wearing sandals, unlikely to wearing socks. And so they were equally exposed, but it must have been culturally more visible to the individuals. Therefore, you have a meaning was that only fingernails would be governed by Shmuel's rule to be makil. But toenails, you let go. It also might have to do with the frequency by which you cut them. And that some of this, or somewhat is determined here, is what's the normal cycle of engaging with these items. So if the normal cycle of cutting nails is more frequent than that of cutting toenails, which is true in general, then also in terms of avelut, where we're going to be makil, is going to be by the fingernails, not by the toenails. The Gemara comes to the end and says it doesn't matter. Both of them we are makel by. Now we have an additional qualification here, which is the important qualification I mentioned at the end of yesterday's shir, which is, Amar Rav Chiya Bar Ashi Amar Rav ubiginostara asur. If you use a tool for cutting one's nails, it is asur. Now ginostara Rashi over here says ginostera is misperayim, is to use scissors, whereas Tosafot over here, Perish Oroch, Shehu Kli, Amitukan, Litotzir Panayim. A nail clipper. I mean, I don't know if they exactly had a nail clipper, maybe they had curved scissors, whatever they had in terms of cutting nails, this was a Kli specifically made for cutting nails. Based on the Oroch's explanation, you might come up with a different conclusion, which is, according to Rashi, Rashi seems to indicate it's any tool that is used for cutting. Like scissors, any tool they use for cutting is problematic. The way the Oroch speaks about it is a tool that is specialized for uniquely made for cutting nails, that would imply that if you used scissors that weren't made for this, then maybe it would be okay. Obviously, that's a key difference between their positions. Now, in addition to that, the Tosafot here discusses something interesting. He says, Rabbeinu Tam Perish, V'kshem shemutar b'shinav, kach mutar litol tzipranav b'zu mechaverta. T'chol zeh chashuv shinui l'inyan Shabbat. So what the Tosafot says over here is that what the Gemara is saying, unlike the Oroch, is not medayik like the Oroch, which is that only with a specialized kli, but anything that's a utensil, which would be considered normal way to remove the nails, that is not permitted. Anything that's considered to be a shinoi would be permitted. What's a shinoi? Well, let's go look in the Gemara in Shabbat. The Gemara in Shabbat tells us when you're chayav and when you are patur. You're chayav when you cut with a kli. You're patur if you bite your nails, or you're patur if you pick off your nails. You do it with one finger to the other. Then you are patur. Again, there there's machloket, whether it's nisur d'rabanan, nisur d'oraita, taking off the nails, and that will impact on the shinoi. Whether the shinoi makes it mutar or makes it only patur v'alasur. But here he says that should govern over here as well, because we see that you're allowed to bite your nails off during avilut. So then the Rabbeinu Tam extrapolates and says anything with a shinoi would be permissible in terms of removing one's nails, which is the way that we paskin. We paskin that that is the case, that as long as you use a shinoi, you're allowed to remove the nails. Then he says, V'shemat v'shem Rabbi Shimon bar Avraham, she'bechol ha'moed mutar litol tzipranayim l'nashim. That women are allowed to cut their nails, even with a scissors, it sounds like, but they're allowed to trim their nails and take care of their nails. Now here he quotes from the Yerushalmi, but if you actually remember back on Daf Tetam with Bet, the Rabbeinu Chananel explained that on the Chol HaMoed, it says there in the Gemara that a woman's allowed to put on her makeup, she's allowed to be pokeset. So we brought different explanations there, pokeset. The Rabbeinu Chananel said that pokeset was litol tzipranav v'sara, which to fix her nails and her hair. So it's similar. That probably came out of the Yerushalmi, but that's the way Rabbeinu Chananel explained it over there. Here too, we see another quote that they thought it was appropriate for a woman to, on Chol HaMoed, to fix her hair and her nails. And that's not considered to be a problem in terms of Chol HaMoed. Then he says, V'tziyachion v'hilchok dolot nami amrinon, v'yisham muteret b'ntilat se'ar lachar shib'ah. That after the 7 days of Avelut, a woman can cut her hair. Says, I don't know where that dispensation comes from. A person is asur when they're Avel, cutting their hair for all the 30 days, for the Shloshim Yom, at least, for a minimum of Shloshim Yom. So how is it he's allowing a woman to cut her hair? It says, V'nira d'v'isha nusua dafka kamar. It's only by a married woman, shalot tidgane al bala. Not that she can literally cut her hair, but she can fix it or lighten her hair slightly so that she doesn't become disheveled and disgusting, so that she's not attractive to her husband. Right? We see these dispensations in other places where a woman can take care of these things so she doesn't become minuval. Then he brings the last interesting thought here, which is v'gam b'shem Rabbeinu Chaim shemati, she'amatir notilat serpanayim b'moed. First of all, you allow people to take their nails on Chol HaMoed. Uv'chalachot gudolot posek shiv'ah asur v'gustere b'shinav mutar. That during shiv'ah, you can't use the kli, but you can use your teeth. V'achar shiv'ah mutar af b'gnostere. And after shiv'ah, you can do it even with a kli. V'yot yidana minale. And I don't know where he got it from. Because if you paskin like Rabbi Yehuda equates cutting hair and cutting nails. And cutting hair is for 30 days, so then cutting nails should be for 30 days. If you paskin like Rabbi Yossi, then Rabbi Yossi said nails and hair are not the same. Nails and hair are not the same, so you can't cut your hair, but you can cut your nails, even during Shiva. So where do you ever come up with a distinction between Shiva and after Shiva? I mean, according to Rabbi Yossi, everything is mutar. According to Rabbi Yehuda, everything is asur. Now, or even if you believe the Yesh Lamar that Rabbi Yossi, even Rabbi Yossi agrees that you can't cut your nails normally, you can't use a kli. He agrees that you can't use a kli. But then it should apply to all 30 days. I mean, why is there a distinction between Shiva and Shloshim? So that's what Tosafot is challenged with. He doesn't know why. But then he says, well, maybe Shiva is like Moed, like Chol HaMoed. Just like Yom Tov is 7 days, so too Shiva is the 7 days. That's the only thing that is governed by this rule. This goes back to what I said earlier, that many times in Avelut, you have to do something that is distinct. With regards to cutting hair, why is it that you can't cut your hair for 30 days? Because the Torah says that a person is not allowed to be parua. For instance, a kohen cannot have become disheveled, let his hair become unkempt. How long is that? 30 days. Because people do not get their hair cut every week. They don't get their hair cut every day. When do they get a haircut? On average, people get their hair cut every month or so, every 30 days or so. Maybe a little longer, maybe a little shorter. But 30 days on average is roughly where people get haircuts. Therefore, if you want to just demonstrate that you're not cutting your hair, you have to wait a minimum period of time where it would be noticeable that one hasn't cut their hair. That period of time would be 30 days. That would be Shloshim Yom. So that's why in terms of cutting hair, Shiva is not relevant. Cutting hair is relevant only on a larger scale, on a scale of Shloshim. I think you could argue that with the nails, that it's different. With cutting one's fingernails, people don't wait a month to cut their fingernails. And cutting one's fingernails is probably a weekly 10-day activity. And therefore, if one was not to cut for Shiva, they'd already be distinguishable that they haven't cut their nails because of this Shiva. Therefore, after Shiva already, to cut the nails isn't a problem because you've already demonstrated that disheveledness of not cutting one's nails. And I think maybe that might be the explanation. That might be what Tosafot is actually suggesting over here. The Shiva is like Moed, meaning that for cutting nails, 7 days already is a period of time that's considered to be significant, that it's noticeable that the person hasn't cut their nails. Remember, you don't get to choose when Shiva falls out. So it already could have been a little period of time before the Shiva happens. You haven't cut your nails, and now you have another 7 days. So you could have, you know, maybe up to 2 weeks, but let's say 10 days of time, and then it becomes noticeable that a person hasn't cut their nails, hasn't taken care, hasn't primed themselves in any way. And I think that is maybe why that distinction of the halachot gudalot, which we don't have a source for in the Gemara, might be relevant because of those time periods, those natural time periods that take place. Right now, the Gemara continues talking about nails here and says, "Amar Rav Shem Ba'aba Abba Kamina Kamei de Rabbi Yochanan Beit Midrashah B'Cholosh Moed." I was in front of Rabbi Yochanan in the Beit Midrash during Cholosh Moed, v'shaklinu l'tofrei v'shinei. First of all, he bit off his nails with his teeth. So this is the source for the fact that even though you can't use a genusterei, you can bite your nails off, because here you have Rabbi Yochanan biting off his nails. That's where the Rabbeinu Tam extrapolated and said it's not just biting your nails. Anything that's not the normal way to cut your nails, anything that's considered to be a shinoi, is okay. V'zarkinu, and then he threw him down. Shema mina tzalat. From this, you can conclude three things. Shema mina, number one, mutar li tol tzipernai b'chol shumoed. You can cut your nails on cholo shumoed. You just can't do it with a genusterei. Whether genusterei means a nail clipper or also any kli, but there is a way to cut your nails on Chol HaMoed, just biting them or peeling them off, picking them off. Shema Mina, another conclusion is, Ein b'hem mishum mius. It's not disgusting to bite your nails. Some people might argue with this, but at least the Gemara concludes here that biting one's nails is not considered to be ma'us because Rabbi Yochanan did it in the Beit Midrash in front of other people. He didn't consider that or didn't see that as being something that would offend other people or be disgusting. It matters of etiquette, culture and time might change these types of things, and therefore it might not be Shema Mina Mutar Lezorkan. The third thing you learn here is you can throw your nails away. So, Ini, is that really true? Batan Yishlosha Dvarim Nemru B'Tziponayim. Three things were said about nails. Hakuvran, someone who buries their nails, Tzadik. Sorfan, someone who burns them, Chasid. He's really righteous. Zorkan, someone who throws them out, Rasha. That person is evil. So time am I. What's the reason behind the fact that we don't want you throwing your nails out on the ground? Shema tavor lehen isha ubra v'tapil. Fear that a woman who is pregnant will pass over them and miscarry. So whatever the reason is, this mystical reason that passing over the nails or cut nails causes a woman to miscarry. So that's dangerous. To throw your nails out is inconsiderate because you're putting other people at risk of losing or miscarrying their baby. Isha be midrasha lo shchicha. The women are not regular attendees or regular passerbys in the Beit Midrash, and therefore, when he threw the nails down, that wasn't a consideration. Bechiteima, you're going to say zimdid mekanchilu b'shalilu abrai. Sometimes they sweep them up or they gather together and they throw them out. Like when they clean the Beit Midrash, the nails are not going to stay in the Beit Midrash. They're going to get thrown out outside, and then the nails will be outside in a place where women are trafficking or traversing, and there it's going to be a problem. Because kevin dishtane ishtane. As soon as they move from their original location, then they're no longer problematic. So here you see two things. One is, this is definitely in the realm of mystical. There's no question about this. It has to, when you cut the nails originally, where that original fall or wherever they fall out originally, that's the problematic. If you move them from that place, they're no longer problematic. In addition to that, the idea that there's a connection between cutting one's nails and a woman miscarrying, whatever that connection is some sort of mystical connection. It probably has to do with what David mentioned before, which is both by hair and by nails in the Kabbalah, they see those as being things that are alive, quote unquote. They're a part of the human body. They grow. And when you cut them, it's as if taking something that's a mate, something that has died. And we know that when it comes to a mate, any part of a human body, we bury it. We make sure that it's taken care of. We don't leave it around. So the same thing would apply to nails and to hair. It's also the same thing with regards to washing one's hands. In terms of washing negelvasser, washing it alternating times your hands, brought down the halacha, the times that you can wash your hands, We know that in the morning when you wake up for the neshama that is returned or for preparation for davening. But the other places that are mentioned is when one cuts their nails and when one gets a haircut or shaves. One is supposed to wash until didam negelvaser for exactly that same reason. Here you've engaged with tuma with the, in a sense, the mate, and you're mitar yourself. You wash your hands because of the ruach tuma that is associated with taking a live object and now cutting it from its source, removing it from its lifeline. And that is why there's a sense of tuma that's associated with it. Also, an idea to bury it or to rid oneself of it. And then it might also apply, I'm not sure how directly or how to connect it specifically, but the fact that a woman will miscarry, which is new life that's being brought, is affected by the nails that are the cessation of this living part of a human being. So there's this connection in the Kabbalistic sense. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Zug ba mechamatan lifnei Rabbi. That a pair of Talmidei Chachamim came from Chamatan before Rabbi. Mezutra matne, Rav Zutra had it as just a stam, a braita, not a memra of an amora, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, rather a braita, which is Zug ba mechamatan lifnei Rabbi. That there was this pair of Chachamim that came for Rabbi. Ubikshu mimenu tzipurnaim. They asked him a shayla about nails. Ve'itir lahem. And he was matir lahem. Ve'im bikshu mimenu safa. Had they asked him about a mustache, Hitir lahem. He would have been matir to them as well. Shmuel Amar, Shmuel says, Af bikshu mimenu safa. They did ask him about a mustache. Ve'hitir lahem. And he was matir for them. Now, what exactly their question was and what the nature of these circumstances are, Rashi over here says that they bikshu mimenu tzipornayim bimei evlo. They asked him about cutting one's nails during avilut. And he says it is mutar. Like the way we passed off in Shmuel before, we passed in halacha, that halacha is kedivrei hamekel by avilut, and therefore it's mutar to remove one's nails. Maybe not with a kli, but it is mutar to remove one's nails. Then, im bikshu mimenu safa, the way Rashi reads this, klomar ani chazina ledate, he says, I saw that Rabbi had in mind, she ishalu legelech safa hayam matir lehem, that he would allow them to shave their mustache. And now listen to Rashi's reason. It's not a problem of cutting one's beard. So Rashi, in the second part of the question, does not associate it with avelut. He's talking about all year round. Their question was simply about, are you allowed to cut your mustache? And the answer, he says, that implied from Rabbi, and Shmuel says Rabbi literally said this, is that cutting one's mustache is not a problem because it's not under the Isur abal tashchit bad zekanecha. Now that has to do with the Gemara we're not going to get so deeply into. It's in the Gemara in Shvot and in Makot about what are the 5 points on the face, which is a Makot Bishonim, where the 5 points are that you're not allowed to cut in terms of shaving on one's face. But what's being indicated over here is that above the lip, above the mouth, is not one of those 5 points. The 5 points don't get up there. That's at least what Rashi is suggesting over here. It is somewhat more difficult because the restriction against lo tashchit Padzikanecha is from the word hashkata, and the Gemara learns from hashkata, that's only derech tar, that's only using a razor. Everybody agrees you can cut with scissors those areas. Now how short or how, there might be questions about how short you can go with scissors, but at least with scissors one is allowed to cut the beard. So it's not clear here what that means. Lo tashchit, I mean, is he saying that you could use a razor on your upper lip? That's almost what it sounds like from the way that Rashi is interpreting this. Now, Tosafot, you can see here, Bikshu Mimeno Safa says, Yesh Lefaresh Ayidei Shinoi, Dumya Ditzipernayim, Dinir Dahachi Perush, Dafka Lachar Shiv'a. So he's, Tosafot clearly views the questions as being parallel. The question about Tzinat Paranayim was about an Avel, and the question about the mustache was also about an Avel. And so he says, well, if that's the case, then to remove the mustache will have to be the same way you remove the nails. You only remove the nails Derech Shinoi. So removing the mustache that he was going to be Matir was only Derech Shinoi. Which is that you can be mekiel on the tar. We're going to see this coming up in the Gemara, but you're allowed to, if it gets in the way, if it's disturbing you, that's halacha that we find by other avelut, by whether it's Sfirat Omer or by the 3 weeks. If it becomes unwieldy and it's hurting your ability to eat, that you're allowed to remove it. You can't just cut it with scissors. You go, you do it with a razor, you slice it up, mean that you do it in a derech shinoi. So that's the way Tosfot understands it, that he was matir them to remove that part that was in the way during avelut, because it's overgrown for derech shinoi. But then he says, that's only lachar shiva. Hakaperush davka achar shiva. It's only after shiva that he allowed it, not during shiva. So anyway, Tosafot clearly sees the questions as being about avelut, whereas Rashi sees the question about the safa as being a broader question, not specifically about avelut. Alright, so now, The Gemara continues and says, Amar Avito Safra Mishmei Derav Safa Mizavit Lezavit. First of all, what is the mustache? The mustache is from corner to corner. So I would assume from the edges of your mouth, from side to side. That's the extent of the mustache. That's number one. Amar Rabbi Ami Ubisafa Makevet. This is what I mentioned to you before, that what we're discussing over here is with a mustache that is getting in the way. It's bothersome. And because it's getting in the way, that is why you're allowed to cut it. It's not just a simple heter. He says, my mustache is always in the way. And therefore, for me, I am, as he calls it, anina datai, that I am a istanis with regards to this. And so anytime my mustache grows out, I already feel uncomfortable about it. And for me, that's as if it's me'akevet. So it doesn't have to be physically me'akevet for him. As long as it's uncomfortable, that for him, it's just, he's so particular that it makes him uncomfortable when it goes out, he's allowed to lighten it. He's allowed to remove it. The halacha, the Shulchan Aruch says that one is allowed to take or cut their nails, whether it's your toenails or your fingernails, even with a scissor, on Chol HaMoed. The Ramah says, Avayesh Machmirim Vosrim, that there are generally people who are osir here, and that's the minhag to be machmir, not to take them off with a sakin or misparayim. But if it's necessary to take them off either derech shinui, or for a tvila of mitzvah for a woman, that she could take them off with a kli. If one did cut their nails prior to the Yom Tov, then the Mishnah Berurah is willing to be makil and say that you can cut them on the Chol HaMoed itself. Because it says, even in Giluach, there are those that are makil if you got it before Yom Tov. So certainly by Tzipor Naim, where they're Deot Dekan or Dekan, one could do it on Chol HaMoed if they did it before the Yom Tov. As far as Avilut is concerned, the Shulchan Aruch says, Kishem Ser Asur Legaleach Kol Shloshim Yom, Kach Asur Lidol Tzur Paranayim Bikli, Aval Biyadav Vishinav Mutar, when it comes to Avilut, first of all, it applies to all Shloshim Yom, and you may not cut your nails, just like you cannot cut your hair. You're allowed to do it Derech Shinoi by using your fingers or your mouth to take them away, or take them off, even during Shiva. So whatever is mutar for the entire 30 days, including Shiva. Whatever is asur for the Shiva and the Shloshim. The Ravush tells you that the difference is about Yipui, that when one cuts the nails with a utensil, it's beautifying the individual, which would be inappropriate during Avelut, whereas biting the nails or picking them off is not a simcha or beautification, it's rather just the removal of something that is bothersome. V'amar Avito Safra Mishmei Derav. Well, now that we brought down a memra from this amora, now the Gemara is going to bring all the memra from that amora, or additional memra that are not necessarily connected, but that they are from him. Paro Shayah Bimei Moshe. Paro in the time of Moshe. It's an important statement of the Gemara, by the way, that Paro is a generic name, or a generic term, because Paro was what they called everybody in Mitzrayim, who was a leader. So that's why we have confusion or questions about, right, Paro, is it the same Paro, is it a different Paro, like in the time of Mitzrayim? Or the Paro in Yosef's time, Paro later on, they're not all the same person, they are a generic name that's given to the leader of Mitzrayim. So here it says, Paro Sheyah Bimei Moshe, Paro in the time of Moshe. Ava Hu Ama, he was an Amato, Uzgano Ama, and his beard was an Ama, Uparmash Teko Ama Bezeret, and his male member was an Ama plus a Zeret. The Kayem Mashinemar, Daniel, Shafala Nashim Yakim Alei, that from the lowest of men will come upon them. So that's it here. This says someone of lowly stature, it is now the one who is ruling over Bnei Yisrael. So not only do they fall in the hands of somebody evil and lowlife, but he's physically of low stature. V'amar Avito Safra Mishmei Derav, Paro Sheyah B'Moshe Amgushi Aya. He was a sorcerer. Shinemar, Hinei Yotzei Hamayma. He went out to the water. Well, why did he go out to the water? So there are one of two explanations in terms of Amgushi Aya. One possibility is he went out to the water because his sorcery, that he thought that the Yaor had some sort of power, so that was the god, whenever he goes out there to perform his sorcery. Or the other one was that the Gdude, that he himself conducted himself like a deity. In order to make himself like a deity, he didn't want people to see the fact that he had to relieve himself like a human being. So he went out to the water and he relieved himself when nobody realized that he was relieving himself because he was in the water. So that was another possibility about this Amgushi Aya, whether it's talking about sorcery or whether he's conducting himself like a deity, but that's why he goes out to the Maima. Why does every, in the Makot, there's cycles of how Moshe and Aaron approach him, but each third Makai approaches him in Eyotzei HaMaima, he's going out to the Yor. Why is he always going out to the Yor? That's what the Gemara is discussing over here. He's going out to the Yor. Truth is, he's going out to the Yor because it's the major water body, artery for Mitzrayim. That means that's where the water source as well as where you bathed, and that's why his daughter is later down there when Moshe is in the Yor, because that's where they went to bathe, that's where they took care of everything. But here's the king, who had servants should have brought the water up to him. What's he doing down at the water? That's what the Gemara is discussing over here, that it had to do with his conduct, what he believed. Now, in terms of what is being said by this Agadato, it's a difficult Agadato. It obviously can't be taken literally, that Paro's an Amah, his beard's an Amah, and his private parts are an Amah. That doesn't make so much sense. The only thing I'll note here is that we know in Sefer Vayikra, Parshei Acharei Mot, in Kedoshim, when Hashem tells Bnei Israel, do not conduct yourself in immorality, it says, don't be like Mitzrayim where you left, and don't be like the Knanim where you came. And so the emphasis here on the size of his member might be an indication of that. Meaning that he's an Amah tall, his beard's an Amah, plus his male member's an Amah, might be this emphasis on immorality, and the focus on Arayot, which is the signature of Mitzrayim. And that might be what's being indicated here, that not only did they fall in the hands of somebody evil, but they fall in the hands of someone who's completely immoral. And that's what we say about Bnei Israel. When they fall, they don't just fall, they fall to the bottom of the bottom. And that's what we know the Midrash, with regards to Bnei Israel and Mitzrayim, that they fell to the lowest form of Tumah. They were at the 49th Shara of Tumah. So this might be a part of that concept, that not only are they subject to a ruler, but they're subject to a ruler who is completely immoral, which means that they are now at the lowest form, or they're beneath that immorality. And so I think maybe that's what's being suggested by the Agadot over here. Ve'lo mechabsim b'moed. These are people who are allowed to launder on Chol HaMoed, abam dinat hayam. Am Rav Asi, am Rav Yochanan, min she'en lo elo chaluk echad. We've discussed this a couple of times. Someone only has one piece of clothing, mutar lechabso b'chol HaMoed. He is allowed to launder it on Chol HaMoed. We saw earlier, how can he do that? How is everybody going to know? Ezuro mochiach alav. His belt will tell you that he only has one piece of clothing, and that's why everybody will know. The reason he's laundering is because he only has one piece of clothing. Meitiv Rabbi Yirmiyah, elu mechabsim b'moed, our Mishnah that says these people can launder in moed. Abam midinatinam b'chule. Hani'in, min she'elo alo chaluk echad lo. The Mishnah never mentions this as one of the exceptions to the rule. I mean that we have all these exceptions that are allowed to launder. How come it's mentioned? Someone who has one piece of clothing. Never mentioned there. I'll explain you our Mishnah. Even though he has two and they got dirty, there is no permission to launder it. So he says our Mishnah is talking about someone who has two pairs of clothing. Even though he has nothing to wear now because they're all dirty, too bad. If you have two pairs of clothing, the assumption is that you get them laundered beforehand and you'll use them, one for the beginning of Yom Tov, one for the end of Yom Tov, and that's it. You don't have permission to launder them. Now, what's interesting here, Tosfot makes a brilliant deal out of here. He says, how come the Gemara didn't make this distinction? There would have been an easy distinction to make here to explain the difference between our Mishnah and the statement of Rav Asi and Rav Yochanan, which is, when he only has one tunic, or one pair of pants, and that's all he has, and he has to wash them, you could have distinguished between whether he washed them before Yom Tov or he didn't wash them before Yom Tov. Let us say that only if you washed them Erev HaRegel, would you have permission to wash them on Chol HaMoed. Because you washed them for Yom Tov, you did what you could for Kavod Yom Tov, but you only have one piece of clothing, article of clothing, so therefore you have to wash it on Chol HaMoed. But if you didn't wash it on Erev Yom Tov, then we're not going to give you permission to wash it on Chol HaMoed. You didn't take care of it for Kavod Yom Tov, so why should you be allowed to do it on Chol HaMoed? The Gemara could have made that distinction and said, our Mishnah is talking about where he didn't launder it on Erev HaRegel, and Rabbi Yochanan is talking about where he did launder it. The Gemara doesn't do that. Tell us what wants to be diet from this, that it doesn't matter. That if you have one piece of clothing, one article of clothing, it doesn't matter whether you laundered it or not on Erev HaRegel, you can launder it on Chol HaMoed. He says, otherwise the Gemara should have made that distinction. And then he goes on to talk about what we spoke about yesterday, about the Avel and the Kohen, who is Mishmar or Avelut, end on Erev HaRegel. So there he says, clearly if Shiva, the seventh day, is on Erev HaRegel, then you can definitely launder during Chol HaMoed, because there was no chance to do it before. But then you can run into the same problem if he had time to launder before and he didn't. Then maybe he doesn't have permission to launder on Chol HaMoed itself. Right, so now the Gemara continues and says, Shalach Rav Yitzchak Bar Yaakov Bar Guyurei Mishmei Rav Yochanan. Klei Pishtan Mutar Dechabsan B'Chol HaMoed. Linen clothing, one is allowed to launder on Cholam Moed. So here the Gemara makes a distinction between Klei Pishtan, linen clothing, and wool clothing. We saw this distinction, Gemara and Tanit, as well, with regards to the 9 days. With the 9 days, there's a difference between Klei Pishtan and Klei Tzemer. There the Gemara talks about the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, Kihutz versus Kibbutz, meaning that the, I'll call it, difference between dry cleaning and laundering. And that does have a distinction within Klei Pishtan versus Klei Tzemer. So we know that there is such a distinction within clothing, that there is a differentiation in laundering clothing. Here the suggestion is that Klei Pishtan, linen clothing, is less burdensome to launder or is easily laundered, and therefore it's not restricted on Chol Shem Oed. Meitiv Rava, Rava says, our Mishnah says, Mitapchot HaYadayim, Mitapchot HaSaparim, and again over here, Saparim, we talk about in the Mishnah that there's three different ways to read this, Mitapchot HaSaparim, Mitapchot HaSvarim, or Mitapchot HaSoferim. So any one of those, the towels, either associated with the barber, meaning that's the cloak that you put on to catch the hair, that would be Saparim. Soferim is the cloth that they put down when they're reading, learning with the kids, so that the oil and the candles don't spill on the Sfarim that are there. And the other one is Matpechot HaSfarim, which means the covers of the Sfarim themselves that get dirty all the time, that you're allowed to launder them. So those are allowed to launder. Hani in. Our Mishnah gives you the things or the exceptions to the rule. What about you're allowed to launder? Klei Pishtan lo. But it does not give you a dispensation for linen clothing. Samalei, Abayi, Matitan, Afilu Shar Mineg. That's easy to explain. Our Mishnah is talking about any material. Our Mishnah says, with any material, these are the items that you can launder. With Klei Pishtan, that's an exception. Amar Bar Hidaya, Lididi Chazili Yama Shel Tveria. I went out and saw the Kinneret. The Mafkila Mishichle Demani Kitna B'Cholo Demo'ada. Says, when I went out in Cholam Oed, I saw the Kinneret full of these laundry baskets, or these buckets, in which there were linen clothing on Cholam Oed. So he brings that as evidence to the fact that you're allowed to launder on Cholam Oed. So now the great question, Matkvah Abayabai says, what type of who is that? Man Lemavan Debritzon Chachamim Avde. Who says that those people out there laundering were listening to the halacha? Maybe Dom Mishlo Britzon Chachamim Avde. Who says that they were abiding by the halacha? The people there could have been violating the halacha. You can't bring evidence for the fact that people are doing this. They might be doing the wrong thing. Although we generally say that if the Am as a whole is doing something, that there might be something to that. But Abayi says that can't be a conclusive proof that it's allowed, because just because they're doing it doesn't mean that it is allowed to be done. All right, next Mishnah. Ve'elu kotvim b'moed. These are the items that you're allowed to write on Chol HaMoed. Kiddushei Nashim, Vigitin, Vishovarin, Dadiki, Matana, Uprizbulin, Igeret Shum, Vigeret Mazon, Shtari Chalitza, Umiunim, Shtari Birurim, Gzerat Beitin, Vigorot, Shel Rishut. Here's a list of items where you're allowed to write on the Chol HaMoed. Go through each one of them. Kiddushei Nashim is a document of Kiddushim. Over here, Rashi says that they wrote in a Shtar Hariat Mikudeshet Li. That's not so clear. The Gemara will change that or indicate that it's not necessarily talking about literal Kiddushin. Might be talking about Tanaim, which we'll discuss in the Gemara. Gitin. One is allowed to write a get on Chol HaMoed. Shonim differ as to what the reason is in terms of allowing one to give a get on Chol HaMoed. Some say that it's Simchat HaMoed. If someone is stuck in a bad marriage, then getting the get is something that is positive. And since it's a positive, it's part of Simchat HaMoed, and therefore giving the get is appropriate. The other possibility there, Nemuka Yosef writes that this is someone who's traveling overseas, or leaving for a long trip. In their day, when they left for a long trip, there was grave risk that the person would not return. And then the wife would be left as an aguna. So they would give a get beforehand. And that's what the way Rabbi Mukha Yosef says, that you can give the get, that he wants to go overseas, and he doesn't want to leave his wife an aguna, so he's granting her a get as a preventative measure, meaning that if I don't return, she's not going to be stuck. So that's a different view of why the get is allowed, because it's almost like a dover aved, versus something where we're talking about Simchat HaMoed. Then you have Shovarin, which are receipts. That's a case where the lover wants to pay, but the shtar was lost, or he's afraid of the malva coming and collecting twice. The malva is allowed to take the money on Chol HaMoed, because we said this before, it's a dover aved, because the lover might disappear after this or not have the money. If he gets the money, you take it when he has it. So the Lovet can pay back, and the Malva can accept it, and he writes the Shovar if the Lovet is uncomfortable giving it to him without getting a receipt that he paid for it. Daideki is a tzivoy of a Shchiv Meira. It's a Shchiv Meira. Someone on his deathbed can orally dictate his last will and testament, and then they can be written down afterwards. So the Didache is important to the people who are granted the gifts of this person who's on his deathbed, the Shechiv Meirah, because if they don't write it down, they don't have this evidence, it's likely that he'll lose, that he won't get this in the end, because the Edom could disappear. Something could happen, so writing it down is important. Matanah is the same thing, which is that a person could deny the fact that they gave a gift, or they could retract the gift if it's not written down, so you want to document it. Prusbolin is to keep the ability of Aniyim to borrow, and for the Ashirim to lend. In that you're going to shut down the liquidity of the lending market if you don't allow people to write Prusbolin, and they're going to be at risk that their loans are going to be canceled on Shvi'it. Igrot Shum is assessments of one's property. It's usually an assessment of a debtor for the benefit of the creditor. And as part of that process, they rip up the Shtar Malveh. I mean, that when he gets the Igrot Shum, they rip up the Shtar Malveh. Well, if they do the Shum, they rip up the Shtar Malveh, and he doesn't get his Igrot Shum, he's lost on both sides, because now he doesn't have a document for either case. So that's why it's important. Igrot Mazon could be talking about a person who commits to, when he marries a woman, to also feed her daughter. He commits that he will take care of her daughter from another husband and feed her. So this is an Igeret Mazon, or Igeret Mazon also could be a woman who is a widow, that she's granted Mizonot out of the estate. It could be that's the Igeret Mazon that is speaking about here. Then you have Shtari Chalitza Miyunim. You'll get a Shtar that is evidence of Chalitza or Miyun. Miyun is a Ktana who was married off by her brother or mother, only has Kedushim Dirabanan. Before she becomes of age, she's allowed to reject her husband, so it's just the documentation of the miyun, or the chalitza, which are again similar to gitin. Shtare berurin. So here, shtare berurin, the way Rashi explains berurin over here is beru beitin chalek zeh lezeh, chalek zeh lezeh. It's like a division of a partnership or property between your shim, that is evidence of the division by beitin. That's one way to learn it. The Nemuke Yosef, on the other hand, says that the shtare berurin over here is a case where they're doing zavla, where you pick one judge, the other party picks one judge, and between them they pick a third judge. So they came to an agreement on the judges that are picked. So you want to document this, because the fact that they came to an agreement already, right, is a significant matter, and we don't want them to have to back out and do this again. So we document the fact that he picked this judge, and they picked the third judge between them, so that the case can be adjudicated and they don't have to go through this process again. Gezerot beitin, for obvious reasons, if there's a gezerah to publicize it. Vigrot shel reshut, over here there's a machloket. Rashi says, vigrot shel reshut, it's tzivui v'kiyum shel shulton. It has to do with the monarchy, which is the same way it's used in the Masechet Avot, is altid vadal rashut. Rashut over there means the government. So that's why over here he's reading it the same way, that vigrot shel reshut is documents of the government can be written down. Tosafot brings from the Yushalmi that it's a possibility that these are vigrot shalom, that these are correspondence between people. It's a nice correspondence, it's normal correspondence between people, asking, how are you doing? Those types of letters, and that's another possibility as to what the Igorot Rishut are. Obviously, it has an afkamina in terms of what you're allowed to do on Chol HaMoed in terms of writing. Amar Shmuel, Mutar le'areis isha b'chol HaShmoed. Person is allowed to engage to a woman on Chol HaShmoed. Shema yikadmenu acher. This is a principle that comes up not only here, comes up on Tisha B'Av, or during the 9 days as well. One is allowed to get engaged to a woman because someone else might jump the gun and take the woman. So in order to preserve your rights in this woman, you're allowed to get engaged because there's risk. Waiting bears risk with it, and therefore we don't ask you to wait. Now, lema misayile, let's say this is approved to him. Ve'elu kotvim b'moed, kiddushei nashim. So yeah, that's our Mishnah. Kiddushei nashim sounds like you can have erusin on the moed. So this one says, my love, shtari kiddushin mamash. So that's why we explained it in the Mishnah, that we're talking literally about making Kiddushin, establishing Kiddushin. Mar says, lo, shtari psikto. No, we're talking about Tanaim. We're not talking about Kiddushin. How much are you giving to your son? Okay, that's how much you're putting into the joint pot here. How much are you giving to your daughter? Amdu v'kichu kanu. That once they have Kiddushin, that generates a kinyan, heinein advarim aniknim be'amira. An exception to the rule. It happens to be true in secular law as well, but it's an exception in halacha. In halacha, generally, in order for something to be binding, you need a kinyan. So over here, where is the kinyan for the tanaim? The answer is that there is no kinyan for the tanaim because the kedushin themselves generate the kinyan. The fact that the kedushin go through, that amira is enough to bind the tanaim. And it happens to be in secular law as well, that marriage in general has commitments that don't require consideration, which is true in other types of forms of contracts and entering into commitments. by the exception to that rule is marriage, where the commitment might be done verbally, or getting married itself is the commitment and puts you into that position and doesn't have the same rules as normal kinyanim. So the same thing over here, that the tanaim are taken in through the kiddushin. So that's why the Mishnah describes them as kiddushei nashim, even though it's not talking about kiddushim, it's talking about tanaim, because the kiddushim are the way that they seal the tanaim. That's what brings it into a kinyan, is the kiddushin itself. So lema misayle, let's say that this is a help to him. Eino sim nashim b'moed, lo bitulot v'lo amanot v'lo miyamim, b'nei shisim chayilot. What are you not allowed to do on Chol HaMoed, or even on Yom Tov itself? Can't get married, not to a woman for the first time, not to a woman who's a widow, not to Yibum, because it's a Simcha. And then we have the problem of Ein Ma'arvim Simcha B'Simcha, or Simachta B'Chagecha V'lo B'Ishtecha. And then it says, Ha, the diuk is, Ha La'Reis Shari. That means that they only precluded their items that are problematic, implying that Kiddushin is not problematic, and you can do Kiddushin. Mariz here says something that's very important, a fundamental machlok between the Rishonim. Lo mi bai kamar. No, the Mishnah is telling you not only this. Lo mi bai la reis dolo kavid mitzvah. Certainly kiddushim are not allowed during Chol HaMoed or Yom Tov because you're not even doing a mitzvah. Ela afil li sa nami de kavid mitzvah. Even to get married, which is a mitzvah, asur. That is asur. So here you see from, what does Rashi say, the kavid mitzvah? What mitzvah are you doing in Nisuin? So he says, the osek v'pirio rivya. The only mitzvah involved here is pru or vu. That's a machloket arishonim in the Gemara in the beginning of Ketubah, the Gemara in the beginning of Kiddushin, as to whether there is a mitzvah of Kiddushin, is there a mitzvah of Nisuin, or are they only a hechitimtze? Are they only a vehicle for getting to another mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of pru or vu? So do you see that as a mitzvah, or do we see this simply as a matir, an enabler for one to perform the mitzvah of pru or vu? And there you have different sides on the Rishonim. Rosh says that pru or vu is the only mitzvah that is involved here, and the Rambam, who seems to indicate otherwise, that there's a mitzvah, the kadesh, mitzvah the in nisuin. So there are differences of opinion. This Gemara seems to favor highly or heavily the fact that there is no mitzvah in kiddushim, but there is a mitzvah in nisuin. What that mitzvah is makes a difference. Do you say the mitzvah of nisuin is the mitzvah of nisuin itself, meaning that it itself is the mitzvah, or like Rashi says over here, which is the mitzvah is pru or vu? There's no inherent mitzvah to the nisuin. And now the Gemara says, Tashma, the Tana de Beis Shmuel. This is somewhat difficult because we're bringing a proof to Shmuel from a Tana de Beis Shmuel. So we're bringing a proof to Shmuel from a bright thought that is said by Shmuel. That is problems from two perspectives. First of all, you bring a proof to Shmuel from Shmuel himself. So why is that right? Why is that a proof? Number two is, why is there a braita from Shmuel? Shmuel's in Babel. All the braita come out of the Tanaim in Eretz Yisrael. So the terminology itself of Tana Debei Shmuel is also somewhat problematic. Here you could argue it's from the Beit Midrash of Shmuel. They had a braita like this in the Beit Midrash of Shmuel, which is possible, but why should there be a braita that was in the Beit Shmuel that's not coming from Tanaim in Eretz Yisrael, that wasn't known? How come it's known in Bavel and not known in Eretz Yisrael? Again, this is a little bit of a difficulty with this terminology. Tanaim Beit Shmuel ma'arsin aval lo konsin. When it's allowed to get engaged, but not allowed to get married. Ve'no sim sudat erusin. Even if you get engaged, you're not allowed to make a sudat party for that. V'lo miyabim b'nei she'i simcha lo. All these things are a simcha that conflict with the Yom Tov, and therefore you can't do it. Shma mino, that's a proof to Shmuel's position. Again, Tanaim Beit Shmuel being a proof to Shmuel is somewhat of a precarious proof, but that the Gemara views as the conclusion here that he's right. You can't do kiddushin on Yom Tov. Gemara says, "Umi amar Shmuel shem yikad menu acher." Shmuel really worried about someone else jumping the gun and taking the woman before you? "V'amar Rav Yehuda amar Shmuel b'chol yom v'yom bat kol yotzeit v'omeret." Every day a heavenly voice goes out, "Bat ploni l'ploni," that this woman goes to this man. "Stay ploni l'ploni," this field belongs to this individual. "Ela shem yikad menu acher birachamim." The answer is not that someone else will jump the gun, because it's already been predetermined who your basheret is. So what's the difference? Shema yikad menu acher birachamim. Maybe tefillah will affect it. Let's see what that means. Kiha durova. Rava, shamei lahu gavra. Here this individual, debay rachme, he was davening. Amar tizdamin li planita. He's davening his heart out, he wants to marry this young woman. So he's davening, please, please Hashem, let this woman be my wife. He says, don't daven like this. Very important, by the way, what he's saying here. Ichazilach lo azlaminach. If she's ru'uya for you, you will not lose her. Vilo, if not, kafarta b'ashem. Then you have been kofar b'ashem. Okay, here the Rishonim are going to have different approaches to this. We'll get back to it again. We'll have to finish up the Gemara. Now I'll come back. Batar achi shamei tikamar. Then afterwards he hears him saying, oh, ihulu mut mikama, either I should die before her, or I tamut mikamei, or she should die before me. Amalei lava mina lacha lo tibay Allah. Didn't I tell you before, don't daven like this? Don't daven about a specific person. It's very important in general that when we have decisions ahead of us, that you shouldn't daven for the outcome. What you should daven for is guidance, that Hashem should give you the right decision or help you make the right decision. That you should have siyata dishmaya in the decision, not in the outcome. Because in the end, we don't have the visibility or the vision to understand what is the right answer, what's best for us. So you want Hashem to guide us to the best outcome. So you daven in that manner. That's the proper way to daven. Both here, Rabbi says it by marriage. Don't daven for a specific person to marry a specific person. Daven that Hashem should bring you the person that is ru'uya, that is appropriate for you and the best match for you. Don't daven that this woman in particular that you want to marry. And I think it has broader perspective in other areas of life. Anytime you're faced by a decision, don't ask for a specific outcome. Ask for guidance that you come to the right conclusion. Now what happened over here, the way Rashi interprets it is very interesting. Rashi says that first he's davening to marry this woman. Rava says don't daven for this specific woman because Shema yidkadmenu acher birachamim. Why? Because maybe somebody can get ahead of you with davening. What does that mean? He says, don't daven for this specific woman, because it won't make a difference. You cannot marry a woman who's not destined to be your wife. You can daven all you want. It's just not going to make a difference. So just daven that you get the right woman. Ah, so then what was the second statement? He says, well, don't do this, because what he says, kafarta b'Hashem, because otherwise that's kfira on Hashem. Why is that kafarta b'Hashem? Because ba'amana. Because you're going to see that Hashem doesn't answer your tefillah. And then you're going to say, look, I davened and Hashem didn't answer me. Why didn't Hashem answer you? Because it's just not going to change the facts on the ground. The facts on the ground are that this woman's not your beshert. So she's not going to marry. You could daven from here until at the end of time. You're not going to get this woman because she's not your beshert. So what are you going to do? You're going to say, Hashem doesn't listen to my tefillah. That's kafarta b'Hashem. Then what did he do afterwards? He davened that either I should die first or she should die first. He was so upset that he couldn't marry this woman. He says, either I should die, and therefore I won't have to see her marry someone else, or she should die, so I won't have to be alive to see her marry someone else. So then he says, don't do that. Why? Because that might work. Rashi says, that works. That's berachamim. Shemi kadmeru acher berachamim is that the only way someone can intervene with your basheret is he could kill her. That if someone davens that she should die to prevent her, I mean that a woman can never marry another man, but that doesn't mean that she's going to marry you. I mean, that this is the woman destined for you. There's one of two possibilities. Either you will marry her, or she will pass away and not marry someone else. So, Shemi Kamenu Acher Berachamim, the way that Rashi learns it is, that maybe he will succeed in his tefillah. If he succeeds in his tefillah, then he's going to actually cause this woman to die, and you're going to lose your basheret. You're going to cause someone to lose their basheret. And that's inappropriate. That's why Rav Hashem stays him in the second tefillah. That's the way Rashi learns it. I mean, the way I would have read the Gemara, and this is the way that the Ritva reads the Gemara, is that the problem here is not in Kafarta b'Hashem, he's going to die, he's not going to be answered. Kafarta b'Hashem is that you're asking for a woman who is not your bashert. And that might come true. If you daven hard enough, you might get the woman that you asked for, and it's not your appropriate wife. But Hashem already sent out a batkol to say what the measure. So you're right. You're intervening with what was supposed to be. You're counteracting Hashem's will. Hashem said, this is the woman for you. And you daven and you get another woman. So not only you knock on the woman you want, but you also take away the woman from someone else. That's kafarta b'Hashem. That's why Rava says don't daven that way. So what the Ritva is saying is you can't succeed. Davening can succeed to change the outcome, the basheret over here. And since davening can succeed, don't daven because you might change, and that's the kafarta b'Hashem. Then he goes on and then he says the second thing. I should die first or she should die first. So he changes his tune. What's going to happen? He married her. He davened hard, and he got the woman that he wanted. And all of a sudden, he's in a marriage, and he's not happy. And starts to daven now that either she should die or he should die, because he wants out. And that's what Rebbe said, didn't I tell you not to daven this way? I told you not to take this woman, because now look at the predicament that you're in. That's how some of the Rishonim say it. That is the interpretation of the Ran and the Ritva. Or, on the other hand, then Mukhe Yosef suggests, he says, don't do this, because if this is the woman that you married in the end, and Hashem will rectify the situation, and either she will die or you will die, so that she can marry the proper zug, or you can marry your proper zug. So it's not worth trying to overturn the gzeirah min hashamayim, because in the end, Hashem's going to bring it about, and it's just going to cause you pain and distress. So Rava was giving him, first of all, preventative medicine, not to marry the wrong woman. But then if he marries the wrong woman, don't start davening that she should die or you should die. That'll be, because that will be the outcome of what you want, but don't go that path. That's not the path you want to be on. So again, they learn, these other Rishonim learn very differently than Rashi. They say, first of all, you can marry the wrong woman because your tefillah can change the effect. And then be careful, because if you do marry the wrong woman, it's not going to be exactly what you think. It's going to turn out that you're not going to be happy in that situation, and it's going to result in you wanting to die, or her wanting her to die to get you out of this problem. All right, now, Tosafot does ask over here, Tema, Amai lo mishani abizug sheni abizug rishon. Says, why doesn't the Gemara answer over here like it does in the Gemara in Sota, that the difference between your first marriage and your second marriage? That your first marriage is basheret, your second marriage is based on skuyot. That's what the Gemara seems to indicate over there. Rishonim have different views of what that means. Some Rishonim mean literally first marriage and second marriage. Your first wife is basheret, is bat kol. Your second wife is a piz chuyot. That has nothing to do with basheret. Other Rishonim learn that your first wife, your destined wife, is your basheret. If you marry her, that's your basheret. Your second wife, meaning that if you don't get your destined wife and you daven and you get this other woman, that's going to be a piz chuyot because that wasn't your basheret. Therefore, then you're going to be determined by your chuyot. So that's a Zug Rishon, Zug Sheni. It's a subject for the Gemara in the beginning of Sukta. But Tosfot says, I don't understand why the Gemara didn't use that as the answer over here. That's a way you could distinguish Shema Yukad Menu Acher versus Lo Shema Yukad Menu Acher. It makes a difference which marriage you're talking about. If you're talking about Zug Rishon or Zug Sheni. All right. Now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Rami Shum Rabbi Ruvain Ben Itzro Bili, Min Torah Min Nevi'im Min Ketuvim Hashem Yishalish. From each of these areas, you can see that Hashem is destined a wife or woman for a man. When Eliezer, Eved Avraham, comes to get Rivka, then when they say we can't stop him because Hashem basically has ordained the fact that Rivka is going to marry Yitzchak based on all the story that Eliezer tells them at the table. It's talking about Shimshon, the fact that he marries a Plishti, a woman. And they can't understand why is he marrying a Plishti woman when there's so many beautiful Jewish women. So Navi tells us in Shoftim that they didn't understand Mi Hashem Yitzad Davar. That the reason that Shimshon's marrying this woman is because that's what Hashem wanted, and that's what Hashem ordained or destined. It wasn't because there weren't enough Jewish women that were out there. Minak Tuvim Dichtiv, Bayit V'hon Nachalat Avot, wealth and one's house is something that you inherit. Hashem isha maskelet. But from Hashem comes the woman, the wise woman that comes to the individual. Vamara mishum Rabuven ben Itzdrobili. Again, once we already brought a memra from Rabuven ben Itzdrobili, we're going to bring a bunch of them. Vamilav matnita tana, some say it's a brighter outright. Amar Rabbi Ruven ben Itzdrobili, it's not brought in the name of Rav. Ein adam nechshar b'davarim kena so. Person is not suspected. Rumors do not circulate unless a person actually did it. Bimlo asa kulo, if he didn't do everything people are speaking about, asa miksato. There's at least a half-truth to the rumor. There's a half-truth to the suspicions. Bimlo asa miksato. And if he did none of this, he didn't have anything in mind, hirherbi libola soto. He thought about doing it. I mean that he says that there's a semblance of truth in the rumors or suspicions that arise about a person. Bimlo yibir libola soto, ra'achirim shasa v'sameach. If he didn't even think about it, he saw other people doing it, and he enjoyed it, seeing something like that. So here, he says that there's got to be some semblance of truth in this item. Meiti Rabbi Yaakov, is that really true? It says, V'chapu b'nei Yisrael d'arim asher lo kein al Hashem elokeihen. So they say, b'nei Yisrael attributed things to Hashem that he never did. Now over here, it's clear that we say that they attributed it to Hashem, and Hashem never did it. It's not because Hashem did it, and there's some truth to it. Hashem didn't do it, and they were attributing it and putting it on Hashem. So that is clearly not true. You have a rumor, and it's clearly not true because it's talking about Hashem. Where it says, Hatam Nahachi Suda Avud. Over there, Bnei Israel were doing it intentionally because they wanted to upset Hashem. They were attributing it to Hashem, even though they knew it wasn't true, because they were trying to be Machis Hashem. I don't know why the Gemara just doesn't answer Hashem is different. I mean, that should be the answer here. That, right, exactly. That when it comes to Hashem, there you can't make that type of statement or conclusion. Tashma, v'kanula Moshe, that they were jealous of Moshe. Again, here is in Tehillim, talking about the history of Bnei Israel, and it says over there that they were jealous of Moshe, b'machaneh ul'aron kadosh Hashem. Moshe in the campment, and Aaron, who was kadosh Hashem. Rav Shmuel, bar Yitzhak Amar, melamed shekol echad kineh li'ishto mi Moshe. Everyone was jealous of his wife, mi Moshe. Kineh li'ishto is really a terminology by Sultah, which warned their wife not to be mitiached with Moshe because of the handsomeness or the attraction of Moshe. Hata mishum sinahu davut. They did it there because they hated Moshe. Because they hated Moshe, they warned their wives not to be near Moshe, meaning they were suspecting Moshe of arayot, even though it wasn't true. So here the Gemara again is trying to say, look, Moshe is different. And it was because they hated Moshe that they did it. Tashmam Rabbi Yossi, Yehi chalki emi shechoshdin oto b'davar imbo. I want to be amongst those that people suspect, and it's not true. V'amar papa the didi chashdun, people suspected me, b'lavavi, and it wasn't true about me. So but here you see, I'm alright in saying, I want these rumors, because I want them to suspect me and find out that I'm clean. Lokasha. Habakal the posik, habakal the lo posik. Depends what type of the nature of the rumor. If it's a continuous rumor, then it's problematic. If it's a rumor that comes and goes, then that's okay. I mean, they had a rumor about it and then it goes away because the fact that it's not persistent indicates that it wasn't true. And that's what they say. I want people to be chashud me even though it's not true because I'll get the reward. They'll think something wrong about me. I won't worry about it and I'll be fine. I'll be clean as a whistle. And then if it's a rumor that persists, that's problematic because that already indicates there's some truth to it. We call it lo posik, ad kama. What does it mean, a persistent rumor? How much time is that? Abaya amra li aim. Abaya says, my mother told me. We know this from Abaya. Abaya's mother passed away when he was young. He was orphaned, and Rabbah brought him up. So when he says amra li aim, doesn't mean literally his mother. It means the woman who brought him up, his nurse. Domi demata yoma palga. The rumors of the city are for a day and a half. So a persistent rumor means that it persists for a day and a half. That's already considered to be persistent, and that's enough to have suspicions about that type of rumor, and that's the type of thing you don't want. That's if it doesn't stop. It has to be continuous for the day and a half, but if it stopped in between, pasak beni beni, late done, but it's not a problem if it went and came. If it didn't stop because of fear, meaning that if somebody tells them, if you keep talking about this, we're going to kill you, the rumor stopped because they were afraid. It didn't stop because the rumors weren't true. So if there's an outside variable that's causing the rumor to stop, that's not called the rumor stopping. That's only if it doesn't resurface. Navat really means to emerge from the ground, but in our context it means they keep surfacing. The rumors surface over and over again. If it keeps surfacing, even though it didn't happen for a day and a half, but again and again and again this rumor surfaces, that's already indicative of the fact that since it's persistent, even though it's not continuous, it's still a persistent type of rumor. Now this is a key element here, that's as long as he doesn't have enemies. If he has enemies, then it's always a source for rumors. It's because people want him to get into trouble. People want to cause difficulty for this individual. So based on that, there's little evidence from rumors now because everybody has enemies in general, and therefore people are going to cause the rumors to come about because they want lashon hara. They want the person to get into trouble. They want to cause trouble for the person. And therefore there is no truth to the rumor. The rumor is a derivative of their hatred or their dislike for this individual. Rav Soloveitchik had that problem in Boston. There were heavy rumors about the fact that he was being bribed in his kashrut standards because he basically broke up the butcher kashrut mafia and they were upset about it. And so there were rumors, and it was to the extent that the district attorney got involved and they did a full investigation. And the investigation came out and said not only were the rumors not true, but he was the one cleaning up the mess here, and he was the one who was justified in what he was doing, and it was the others that were causing the problems. And so in the end, they gave him an approbation for what he had done, but I know he suffered heavily during that period of time because of these rumors that were circulated, not because they were true, they were circulated by those people who were upset about what he was doing to destroy him and to undermine his authority. So again, that out makes it that likely in most cases that the rumors are not true, or rumors not going, but it's the idea being that, and we saw this in yesterday's Gemara, the question about that Talmud Chacham that had rumors coming about him, you asked me yesterday, what do you mean? Why do we believe the rumors? But here the Gemara tells you that if things surface over and over again or rumors persist, then you have to worry about it because that means that there might be some truth. There is something to it and you have to be careful. You have to look into it, but you have to take these things seriously when they persist. Okay, we'll stop over here before the Mishnah on the bottom of Yuchedim Abed.